it's not working?
I think it's not for recording anyway.
Is it only for recording? Could be, yes. Let's say I apologize for using the PowerPoint presentation here, but I understand that I should introduce to some of you. I mean, what I'm going to tell here is known to a few of you or to a fraction of you very well. But let's say there are different communities which came together, and I understand with my job here that I should try to introduce those who are not so familiar with it yet to what has been done with these chosen communities. And since I will show you some experimental pictures, I'm using this laptop presentation. And I hope you forgive me, at least let's say it was approved officially before, and so I try to go on. Plus, I also like to mention my co-workers, in particular Sascha Schneemann, who's about to move to Innsbruck next month, in a few days from now. Juri Martin has moved back to the Landau Institute a year and a half ago or so. What I try to do in this presentation is to have, let's say, basically three blocks. One is I'll give you a really basic introduction to what are the main ideas with the communities and what has been done experimentally, and this is the part which I have been talking about many, many times. So many of you have heard it before, but I mean, not everybody, and so probably in order to know what these chosen qubits are, it's good, and it's short, and let's say I try to get perhaps some feedback for you, if I see that you understand everything and fast, and if you have questions, please ask me. And also ask me where the third and the rock is to be found. Then the next job, I mean, I was assigned this topic to that, perhaps directly. Quantum engineering needs optics, but let's say I understand, I put this in brackets, what I understand, that what we are doing with chosen qubits and how yes, known from optics, quantum optics are realized in this context. And that then is the second part of my talk here. Let's say I talk about chosen qubits coupled to oscillators, and there's been beautiful work done in Yale, for instance, and Alexander Blass, who is one of the chairmen, is actually the expert on it, but I was assigned to talk about it, so I will talk very much about ideas which he has put forward in this context. And the co-workers, of course. And then the last part, these two last topics here, are referring to some work which we have been doing recently, and which is, let's say, a more specific example to this question of what quantum optics type experiments you can do when you use chosen devices. Okay, so that's the outline of what I tried to cover, and so let me go through it now quickly. So a chosen qubit, I mean, I'm sure everybody has seen here this beautiful experimental picture from the group in Saclay, which shows such a small superconducting island. This is an important part of the island, where we have very controlled the number of Cooper pair charges. They are coupled via tunnel junctions, chosen junctions to electrodes, actually two of them, so we can control this coupling effectively by the light flux. And it's also coming capacitively to gate capacitance, which gate voltage is controlled very well. If you go through, try to analyze the Hamiltonian of such a system, you end up with a big form which is given up here. It depends on, say, charging effects, what we know from simple electron charging effects, or what the important quantum degree of freedom is the number of Cooper pairs on the islands, and it has the charging n times e, which is taken out DC, then it's this energy scale, the charging energy. And we control this charging energy by gate voltage. Somehow, if you turn on the gate voltage, the minimum energy state has then an increasing number of extra charges to compensate. And this quadratic form indicates. And on top of it, we have this chosen coupling and these junctions given here. And let's say a chosen junction, we know there's this complex order parameter, the phase, and a chosen junction with current flowing depends on the difference of the phases, this data here, and the energy is then the chosen coupling energy, which depends on this current times the cosine of that phase difference. Now, with the flux, with this double junction arrangement which you see here, and the flux of the control variable, you effectively control this chosen coupling strength. Now, what is important, and we have been playing with that for more than 20 years, it was started all with this work of Caldera and Leggett, who asked, can we see macroscopic quantum effects and who pointed out that such a choice injunction is an ideal device to test these questions. From that time, we know that the this charge on the tile and the phase across the junction are quantum mechanical conjugate variables in a complete analogous way to momentum and position of a quantum particle. Now, I wrote the commutator here, and this form took out the charge and say, I mean, you put you could put an h bar there. I could have rewritten it to some extent to see the h bar over I, which I want to see for momentum and position, but I prefer to be dimensionless as it's written. Okay, so we have two characteristics. So this is the important thing. It's a quantum system, and this indicates here the quantum measure. We have two energy states, the charging energy depending on the capacitance of the system and the choice uncoupling depending on these junctions here, and which you see here, and we have two control fields. Now, there are various situations, and I think here I will keep everything short here. I mean, you can go to extreme parameters where only two charge states play a role. This is actually what, let's say, what is the charge qubit? There's a charge qubit when, say, you have the different charge states, but you can imagine that you can go to near the situation near the degeneracy point, that two charge states, n and n plus 1, are nearly degenerate. And then, say, a small Josephson coupling is important. And then all the other states are far away in energy. So that this is one of the situations where this system actually reduces to a quantum two-state system. But actually, I don't even need that. I mean, you just say, look, this system has a ground state. Depending on the applied gate voltage and the applied flux, these are the two control fields. It has an excited state, which I have here. And if I use resonance techniques, I'm inducing transitions between these two grounds. These two states and all the other states are just out of resonance and I don't talk to them. They may be far up, then it's doubly good, but even if they are not so far away with the resonance techniques, I only talk to two states. And then we have a two-state quantum system, and that is the Josephson qubit. It's written here.
Yes, please. Just a quick question. I've always been slightly confused by charge states, and like, if I had two Cooper pair boxes and I was shuffling charges between the two, that seems like an isolated,
version.
But if I've got a lead going off and I'm actually moving something out in the lead, in fact, that lead seems like it's coupled everything and the sort of decoherence properties of the lead seem to never come in to this kind of thing, and that always confused me.
Let's say the point is that also this electrode here is a superconducting one. What's the more important is that it's a Cooper. So all this electrode actually. Gets the wrong answer. This electrode is the superconducting one, and so you have the coherence. I mean, you are right in principle. Let's say if you would do the same thing with, say, you can have two charges, say, take two quantum dots with an electron being either the left or the right dot, and you would again have a quantum two-state system, and then you want to do what you described. If I would have the system in a normal state, I would have to worry about what you say, because then I could have an extra electron on the island or gone. But then if it comes back to the big electrode, there's a big many-body system, and it's unlikely that this particular electron comes back in a coherent way, and it would be incoherent. But in the superconductor, we have this whole system is behaving in this macroscopic quantum coherent way, as written here. So there's, let's say, the superconductivity enforces that you have only this collective degree of freedom, the phase difference across the junction. And that's why
so the superconductivity provides the coherence, and the bond is really just giving you a charge.
Right, so precisely, yeah. So if I would play the same thing with the normal system, it would not hurt. But your extensions, which you described, going say two quantum dots, where have just a single level in each one of them. But again, Durkin hasn't done experimentally. There have been experiments and demonstrated it. But actually, there's lower coherence than this one. So, say, if for some reason now I can reduce the system to a quantum two-state system, you see I have a form which looks like a typical qubit, like a spin in a magnetic field, and I can control what corresponds to the magnetic field in that direction by applying, by controlling this gate voltage, and I can control what corresponds to fields in the x direction by the flux. Now, there have been beautiful experiments demonstrating it. The first one was by Nakamura and Koberger's 8 years ago by now, who showed that if they prepared the system in a superposition of eigenstates, they get the quantum mechanical coherent oscillations, which is here as a function of time. Time scale is 100 picoseconds here. The first experiment did not have a good phase coherence time. It was only 5 nanoseconds at that particular case. That's controlled depending on the that situation became substantially improved. The breakthrough experiment by the experiment of the Saclay group, which you see here, that the phase coherence time has gone up by 2 orders of magnitude and another order of magnitude has been reached in the meantime. It is an experiment with a name already taken from quantum optics, Ramsey fringes. By controlling these fields, I mean, it's actually AC techniques. You do a Harvey try to turn, say, you start with initially developed gas state, and you turn on the AC driving, the Rabi driving to prepare the system to do a pi or 2 pulse to prepare the XY thing. Then you let it evolve coherently, and after a certain delay time later, you do another pi over 2 pulse, and then you measure it by measuring the Z component, and then this is the result. You see, it's doing the quantum mechanical coherent oscillations. Actually, what you see here is actually only a beating pattern. There was many more oscillations. The quality of this device is 20,000, so you should see 20,000 oscillations, which you cannot plot. So that's why the beating pattern is shown here. And then you see, I mean, the phase coherence time has gone up substantially. So that was definitely a substantial breakthrough. For, let's say, there are other versions of qubits, and two more are being discussed. One is the flux qubit. The simplest version would be just such a superconducting ring with a junction. It has also an inductance, so in addition to what I introduced already in Hamiltonian, you get an inductive part added like that, and if you plot it, well, you get a situation where you can have such a double well potential, and then we have the tripping quantum, double well situation, which again reduces to a quantum two-state system. The two lowest states are characterized by a circulating current going one way or the reverse way, but obviously they are macroscopic distinct. So let's say that has been studied, this R-split arrangement also was studied theoretically for more than 20 years. Somehow it seemed to be experimentally difficult to show this, what you expect here, say, for instance, again, coherent oscillations. A breakthrough came with the design which Hans Moy brought about. He understood that he can make the system smaller and less susceptible to fluctuations and noise by having a three-junction system. So most of the flux qubits today are such three-junction devices. Then you have, again, say, you have a landscape with phase differences across the junctions, the third one is fixed. And then you have, say, two minima, and it's a double well potential against John.
So in the spirit of this conference, I'll make a comment. Yes. You very nicely said that by adding the two junctions, you made it smaller, which means it's not going to couple to the rest of the world, and it's better. The problem is when you don't couple to the rest of the world, it's harder to get two of those qubits to couple to each other. So I wanted to point out that a lot of the things that people are doing in their initial demonstration of the qubits kind of come back and haunt them when they start to actually starting to couple qubits. You can do it, but it just makes it harder. And there's always this kind of trade-off going on between doing things to get the qubit, the single qubit, to work better. A lot of times when you do that, it gets harder to couple them. And that's something we're working on. I mean, this is absolutely the thing you want to do. But then you kind of have to pay for it later when you start trying to scale up.
So that was part of the task of the market.
Great. So I'm trying to generate a discussion.
Thank you. So you see already, and I'll come to the highlight of the two coupled qubits in a little while. You see the state field is at a very early stage. I mean, we try to understand one qubit. Now, after 2 qubits, and so whatever was the best at this stage should be discussed. Actually, here we come to something which John points out. This is the work of John Martinez. He actually made the observation that even, say, a very simple system, a single junction, a current-wise junction, which again you see here, this part of this tilted washboard potential which you have there, has the property you want to have to operate as a qubit. Namely, there are eigenstates, and there's a low state, and first excited state, and you can address them by resonance techniques. You actually can also use, for instance, a third state in the part of the measurement process. So, and let's say, indeed, I mean, this system then is actually the other systems which I showed you before, where pushing parameters, I mean, you go to, say, nanofabrication, that we use the word, you try to get capacitances in the range of 10 to the minus 15 farad. That is the scale which we know where you see single electron effects, because then this energy scale DC, which I introduced, is of order of 1 Kelvin. And so at sub-Kelvin experiments, you see the single electron effects. Now, here, this was actually a much larger capacitance, three orders of magnitude larger. And so you wouldn't have seen the charge condensation and so forth, but you see these microscopic quantum effects which are there. And let's say it has been, this is again in the spirit of work which has been done for more than 20 years. The quantum tunneling was first studied on such a particular system that at low temperatures you have not only thermal activation but also tunneling through the barrier. And now John and his co-workers showed that this is actually also a good system to use as a qubit. And you will perhaps say more about it in the course of the week and what can be achieved with that. I want shortly to say that theoretically, we have been thinking about coupling them, and actually, let's say, so that is one arrangement which you could imagine, that you put many of such qubits in an LC circuit arrangement, which you see here with the inductor here. The coupling comes about by the current going, which is the sum of all the currents in all the qubits, which then has a distribution due to the inductor, and if you see that couples, obviously, all the qubits. It's actually something which we're discussing now, coupling qubits to LC oscillators, has always been around this idea. Actually, it is, when we proposed it, we were driven very much to think about it because of the idea of Chirac and Soller, who told us that you couple these atoms in an ion in an ion trap via the phonon modes, and so we look for this equivalent of the phonon mode in oscillations. So it's nothing, but unfortunately, let's say that has not been experimented.
Jimmy,
yes,
how do you get away with just a single inductor?
The capacitance is here. The capacitance of the junctions are there. Of these.
Yeah, but don't you want all the mutual inductances covering the different?
Let's say here, this was, it could be, sorry. Let's say what we had in mind here was the charge limit, the charge qubits. Okay. You are right, I mean, there could be a coupling also via mutual, and actually what I'm showing you in a second will be coupling via mutual inductances. But this was in the charging regime, and somehow it was assumed that the mutual inductance which would be here was negligible. Which certainly would put some requirements, constraints on how far you want to separate them and so forth, which actually, I guess, you could imagine to do. Still, let's say there was a limitation in how many we can couple, because we need to have the dispersement frequency, this oscillator frequency, which depends on this capacitance in a certain parameter range. So we imagined 10 is easy to couple, but not 100, at least theoretically. So let's say, still this short introduction, I show you a very recently published paper by the Delft group, who used this three-junction qubit, flux qubit. It's flux qubits, you see a 2-1-1, and the second one, they are put in this arrangement to balance the external fields, and they are coupled via mutual inductance. Let's say it's driven by again, AC techniques. What you see, the qubits are the gray stuff, and the pinkish stuff are the readout splits and so forth. And what they showed in this paper was that they can demonstrate a controlled knot operation where they use either qubit as a, one qubit as a control, the other as a target, and vice versa. And you see here, and actually, it shows a bit also again the dust under the rug. I mean, you see, let's say, what you expect is this truth table. I mean, it should be 1-1 here, and that we have the off-diagonal component 1-1. So you see something like that is going on, but you also see it's far from 1 and it's far from 0. So the quality of this knot operation is not spectacular. We are really still very much at the beginning. On the other hand, as far as I understand the paper, they show, what you see here is, of course, the probabilities. This is only magnitude squares, which you see here, measured ones. But they also could study, they did so-called full-state tomography, measuring really the phases of the density matrix, what you get after your manipulations by performing further coherent oscillations, and in that way getting information about the phase. So I think that's...
Yeah, I mean, yes. So they use what sort of, they did not only use states like 0, 0, 1, 0, 1 and so on as input, they used all sorts of superpositions as input states, or?
Yes, or let's say that it may be actually true, but I think what they did more was, say, depending on how long you apply the operation, you shift the phases accordingly. And what they did, I think, was that they performed another, say, they drove the system again in an RV way, and after a certain point, and that they showed that it was oscillating, so they had a certain value of the initial phase. In this paper, they show also this field of resistance. That's how I understand it.
Yeah, and if you... if you want to do full process and state tomography and process tomography to really understand what that gate's doing, then it requires you to put in some pile or two pulses and some sequence. And that's really not perfectly done in this experiment, but that's something we have done. And it seems to work okay. I mean, given what they can do, this was a very good experiment, but it is possible to start doing the full state and process tomography, and I can show you data on that. And I'm sure they'll get to that very soon. I mean, this is really within the realm of what we know how
to do. By the way, what you see here is that ideally, when you want to control the two-qubit gate, ideally you want to have, say, control over the coupling to be able to turn it on and off. But this was a fixed coupling, and so the only way, let's say, they were treating it like, let's say, what you have in NMR, you have also fixed coupling, but still you can do all the manipulations by being able to do all the single bit operations. So that is the level where we are. But ideally, if you want to scale it to larger systems, you want to achieve control over the coupling. Let me come now, this is the still this introductory part, talk a little bit about noise and interference, which we have been thinking about much in Karlsruhe. Let's say there is lots of noise sources, and I see out here just two. One is that, say, whenever we have such a qubit, we want to control and read out, want to control and read out, and that means we have to couple our qubit to a control circuit. So whatever we need to control, if the system applies gate voltage and so forth, will also deliver noise to the system. The same about flux. Now, typically, this circuit, I mean, it's an electric system, and say we know from electric engineering that we can describe these electric circuits like complex impedances set of omega. In the simplest case, it's just the system. Now, another one which turns out to be very important, and let's say this is what these solid state physicists encounter in many, many circumstances, and atomic physicists don't know perhaps about it, at least much less, is that there's 1 over F noise. I mean, 1 over F noise is everywhere in the world, the fluctuations of the level of the Nile, that 1 over F noise, and so obviously it's also here. So, and actually, again, Sean made a major contribution to identifying this noise sources. It appears that there are lots of two-level fluctuators in the material, in the oxide of the chosen junctions, for instance, in the substrate and whatever. These devices, which I propose to you here, are single charge devices, single electron devices. They are known to be very sensitive devices to measure little voltage fluctuations. That's the good part, but the bad part is they are very sensitive to it, and so very little, all these fluctuations in the substrate, whatever these material-specific properties, affect the coherent behavior in a strong way. And so, let's say, typically, these background charge fluctuations were an impurity charge. One electron decides to hop from one side to another nearby side. They are there, many of them, and they frequently have a 1 over F spectrum for reasons which we have no particularly good feeling for, but we observe it again and again. And so, let's say, so if we are going to discuss it, there are typically two examples which one likes to discuss, either the ohmic spectrum which we would have for a resistor in the circuit, or the 1 over F which we have in the background charge fluctuations. It determines what is this correlation, this power spectrum of the noise, we have the fluctuating quality X, the correlation function for the transform symmetry, that's a 2D quantum. And say if it's an ohmic resistor, it would have this one. It's wide in the limit of frequencies more compared to KT, then the omega just cancels. and it's one over BT, but say the one over H is here, or it's one over OKW, OK, there's one over H. Let's say there's more to be discussed, but you can theoretically be like you treat it as Gaussian noise. This is certainly a limit, which is that applies when the central limit theorem applies when you have many fluctuators, all of them weakly coupled. But then we can have situations where we see that the vicinity of such a qubit are a small number. John has nice examples of about 20 two-level fluctuators, which he can resolve spectroscopically. You see, as he changes the resonance frequency, he sees one after the other of these about 20 two-level fluctuators. And then, of course, you get results which differ from the Gaussian approximation. I will describe shortly what we do with Gaussian. But then, let's say still, I didn't really mention it so much. Sorry, I forgot to say that, but I have to say it here. What was the improvement? What was the reason for the improvement of this experiment as compared to that one? It is actually hidden here. Namely, it was, and this will again pop up again and again, so it's important that I express it in this first talk here. Say, if you have an arbitrary operation point somewhere, then you see that small fluctuations, either of the gate voltage or the flux, will change the energy spacing between ground state and excited state. And then your coherent oscillations, which oscillate with that frequency, will get a random random contribution to this energy spacing, will lead to rapid defacing. Okay, now the way to improve that is go to such a saddle point, as indicated here by this solid black line. Then you see if you have small fluctuations in the gate voltage of the flux, this energy spacing changes only quadratically. And so your noise doesn't couple linearly to the system anymore, but only quadratically, and much lower. And that was actually a major contribution why this experiment here is so much better than the other one. I'll show it to you in the next plot as I go on. But now, this, I was reminded that I have to talk about it on this case. So when we talk about this noise, then apart from the spectrum, which I mentioned now already, we have to decide, of course, or the question is how it couples to the qubit. Let's say it's a natural basis for the qubit. I assume it would be diagonalized. This is the eigenbasis of the qubit. And then in this basis, the noise can either couple it also to tau z, which we call longitudinal, or it can call to tau x, which is called transverse. Or if you are at this optimum point where we make the linear coupling, longitudinal coupling vanish, we then have to worry about the quadratic coupling. That is important for several of the applications which you have in mind. And typically, if we try by, if at all possible, to go to the point where this sweet point is called sometimes sweet spot, where this linear heating decoherence mechanism vanishes, and then we have to think about that. Now, there has been work in the 80s and so forth studying the linear, what happens if you get only the linear coupling, longitudinal or transverse. And well, it leads to some exponential decay, say, of the off-diagonal component of the density matrix. Off-diagonal and diagonal, sorry, I mean both here. There are two, I didn't show the block equations, I assume you know. There is relaxation, which shows how the diagonal components of the density matrix relax to a thermal equilibrium. And if you use golden rule with that particular noise here, you find that the relaxation rate depends on the power spectrum of the noise at the frequency equal to the lattice spacing. The longitudinal noise gives rise to this defacing to the fluctuating energies, and it has a contribution to this pure defacing, which depends on the low frequency part of this power spectrum. Relaxation also gives rise to defacing an additional contribution. So that is what you get with simple arguments and interpretation theory, and it is perfectly sufficient if you want to describe, for instance, the effect of a resistor. We get regular expressions and everything is fine, and you can actually, if you put in numbers for these Schrodinger devices, you see the resistance is compared to the quantum resistance here, and there are, let's say you can try by choosing capacitance and try to get a very small pre-factor, so actually the fixed rates would be encouragingly low. And we would be happy if we built quantum computers by now, if that would be all. But unfortunately, this 1 over F noise is the real bad guy. And then you see here, we have to do more work, because this golden rule type analysis is not sufficient, and of course the nonlinear coupling is the same story. I very quickly show it has been done, say 1 over F noise, for instance, gives rise to a decay of the octagonal component of the density matrix, which is not a simple exponential, but equal to the minus T squared law, but we still can see it decays, and then the rate, the characteristic rate for decays depends on the strength of this 1 over F noise. Sasha Schneemann, you and Martin also investigated this quadratic coupling, and in that case, you get a power law decay of the octagonal component of the density matrix, and again, you can read out the time scale, which depends on, or I didn't write it here, it again depends on the spectrum of the 1 over F noise. I summarize all that, this is the end of this part of my talk. Say, for instance, returning to this Sacquet type experiment, it shows how the coherence time across this is 300 nanosecond phase coherence time, which is this spot here, at the optimum point, the sweet point. If you move away from it, either in voltage, gate voltage direction or in flux direction, you see how this rate very quickly, this times very quickly decrease. The red curve indicates what you can achieve when you apply echo techniques, to take out the low frequency part, and so it does need to improve. We understand pretty much how it, and there are other experiments which I don't have the time to go into, which show how, let's say, the moving away from the ideal point, the how it can behave, and we understand the behavior. I come to my second block now, the part of my talk where I try to talk about the coupling of qubits to oscillators. And let's say there has been this really, again, breakthrough experiment reported in 2004 by the Yale group, and let's say there's Barlow was the first author, you see Sherlock Gerling, Alexander Glaser is here tomorrow, has been providing theory input to the Gerling before. The system which you see here, this is again such a qubit, a small island with a double junction seen here. It is coupled to a resonator. In that case, it is a long transmission line. I show you now the schematic picture of it in a short while, but here you see already what it is. It has certain advantages, and we can discuss more. I can only shortly touch it here. Now, what do we have here? I more or less copied from their abstract. We see we have this two Cooper pair box here, which quantum superconducting two-level system. And for quantum optics people, it is the same. It takes the role of a two-level atom. It is coupled to a cavity consisting of the superconducting transmission line resonator. That is the cavity which quantum optics people know from their work. And now what is the unusual result is you can reach a strong coupling regime. I'll show you numbers in one of the next transparencies. So that actually, it is not just redoing what quantum optics is doing, but it is in a different parameter regime. I mean, so it is, it's new and because of different parameters, although a lot of the ideas which have been developed in quantum optics, we just take over, try to see that we cannot reproduce it as well. And so the coherent interaction of this quantum two-level system with a single microwave foothold has been observed. At the same time, the group in Delft, it was published back to back, produced another system, again, this three-junction flux qubit, which then again is the quantum two-state system, and it is coupled to a grid, in black here, and this grid serves two purposes, which is said here. It is actually the readout device, but also this grid is an inductor, which together with some parallel capacitors, or stray capacitors, not stray, I should say, but let's say with an external shunt capacitance, makes it an LC circuit, so you couple, in that case it's only an LC circuit, not the transmission line, you couple your quantum two-state system to an LC circuit, and you get, say, you see here it's the qubit, but then shifted by the number of quanta in this oscillator, and they showed in this particular setup that they can get Rabi oscillations between, say, the 0,0 and the 1,1 state, or this diagonal transition. So they have entangled states between the qubit and the resonator, and they drive Rabi transitions between these two systems and see the corresponding resonances. Now here, a bit schematically, more first of all, I mean, this is of course what quantum optics people usually talk about, the atomic cavity. Now here, this transmission line example was this, again, this qubit here in this transmission line, and it couples to the modes in this transmission line, the particular mode. And so we have a qubit, quantum state system, oscillator system. Here's a simpler version, the charged qubit coupled directly to an LC oscillator. I'll say a little more about that in a second. That is the system which I want to cover later. There's a driven flux qubit coupling to an oscillator, which has also been, all these are, say, has been studied experimentally, and are examples of this, say, extension of the outlet essentially like regions. So this is actually just taken from Alexander's Blaise's article in Coburgers. So let's look at this particular, this example, this Cooper pair box, which I described with the junctions on the island, and couple it to a resonator. So here you recognize the Hamiltonian issue set before. Here's the resonator. And if you study a bit what, I mean, so these fluctuations, or the zero-point fluctuations or whatever, of this oscillator coupled to the qubit just as the gate voltage does, so if one analyzes it, one finds couples, I mean, the gate voltage couples to sigma z, so obviously you get a coupling of this time, the displacement of this oscillator coupled to the second component. Now, if you go to the eigenbasis of the qubit through sigma z, then this, and do random gate approximation, then you have here a realization of the change coming in Hamiltonian and all the interesting physics which is derived from it. But now let's look a bit at the parameters. So the qubit has typically a level spacing of order of 10 gigahertz. And this coupling of the James-Cummings model comes from this coupling which we have here. And the amplitude, I mean, well, it's basically just copying from here. If you put in numbers, you realize it's about 100 megahertz. And let's say that, I know less about atomic physics, but apparently this is much larger than what one typically achieves in such a quantum, real quantum optics setup. One reason is you can express it as a, you can estimate from that, I mean, you can translate it into an effective dipole moment, and then you see it's a large dipole moment, 10 to the 4, and this atomic universe. Let's say, I mean, of course, you can then with this, you can get, say, the vacuum-Rabi splitting, which I'll return to. One of the experiments was looking at the vacuum-Rabi splitting. The other limit one can look at is that one goes into the, that assumes large tuning, which is called the dispersive regime, and then can rewrite the Hamiltonian in such a form by some unitary transformation. And so you see here the AC Stark effect, and here you see the lamp shift. So what you see is that, let's say, the resonator shifts the resonance frequency, the frequency of the oscillator, and it depends on the state of the resonator. Or you can read it vice versa, that the qubit shifts the frequency at the eigenfrequency of the resonator, and again, it depends on the state of the qubit. So you can now use this in a dual way. You can either use the qubit to get information about the state of the resonator, and I'll show you an example in a second, or vice versa, you use the resonator to get information about the state of the qubit. And so, I mean, both of these are being pursued. Well, this picture is again from a very recent paper of this Yang group. They plot here, this shows the value of the G in some unit, it compares how, say, how what values you can reach as compared to, say, one typical quantum optics experiment. You can get a much stronger coupling, and the upper axis is the tuning. And then you have the resonant vacuum-Rabi regime and the
okay. I wanted to make a comment about this in a general sense.
Yes.
It's looking at this, what you're doing here, in a maybe slightly different and experimental language. I mean, the reason why coupling to this electromagnetic mode is so interesting is when you have qubits that really don't want to couple over long distances. It's kind of, it doesn't couple to the rest of the world. So you first couple it to this mode, and then that mode will couple it. So you can get long distance communication, which is important. Now, the reason, let's see, let me try to explain this. This mode, being an electromagnetic mode, has an impedance around free space impedance. So these lines, these are electrical circuits, they're 50 ohms, that's roughly what you could experimentally, it's going to be something about 377 ohms. And what you do is you use essentially resonant coupling to impedance match your little atom, which is not impedance matched to the rest of the world, it's quite a good qubit, to 50 ohms, and then that resonant coupling then goes down the line, and you can impedance match to another qubit and get this to work. Now, the reason this works so well is because atoms have very, very large impedances. Megaohms, hundreds of megaohms, they're really badly impedance matched to free space. That's why they have long life. And the charged qubits have an impedance of, say, 100 kilo-ohms. And that's different than 50 ohms, but not too much different. And then you can do it.
Okay.
And then what's interesting is, although the charged qubit works very well, the flux qubit has even lower impedance, and the phase qubit has 10, 50 ohm impedance, and can very strongly couple. In fact, we did an experiment in Saclay in 1989 or 90, where we coupled a phase qubit to a transmission line, and we were able to get like gigahertz coupling strengths.
Okay.
So once you get use a lower impedance atom qubit, then yeah, all these things are possible.
I can kind of see how you do it for a circuit. How for an actual atom you would define impedance?
Yeah.
That's a good question, and you would have to maybe define some coupling electrode, and then you could talk about effective coupling. And you're right, there's no two lines, you can't do that. So you have to talk about the effective coupling, and it's not a perfect analogy, but it's the kind of language that is very amenable to this kind of discussion. So you're right.
Here I try to call it a dipole moment, like, which I wouldn't necessarily, I could do it for you, but in order to make contact with the atomic language, and now you try to express it in this impedance mismatch, and then you would have to somehow find a bridge to a...
But this, I think this is kind of the language of what's going on here.
Right.
Why this is different than the atoms,
right.
And why it works better is because it's a lower, it's matched to electric, it's matched to photons.
Right.
It's a big atom that's matched to photons, either in dipole moment or impedance. And this is a really important concept to do. Impedance mismatching is kind of hard to understand. But it's really, I think, the right kind of concept you want to be thinking about.
I'll go on.
I have one question because I'm not quite sure when I missed something. So in cavity QED, there are sort of three important numbers. So one is what you call G, the atom energy coupling. One is the lifetime of the cavity.
I didn't talk about that yet. I didn't talk about dissipation terms yet. Actually, I have in mind to associate a little bit about the data, but not so much.
And what's the third one? The lifetime of the qubit.
There's a damping of the qubit, and there's a damping of the oscillator. Yes. And it both has to be... It's super unrestricted. If you do something once, it's 50 meters. Perhaps here, a short comment, again, from Alexander Pleasant for Burgers. Actually, a very recent paper, they discussed that this, it has been around the idea that you can use this to couple qubits here, as indicated here. There's another observation that this transmission line can reach a very high quality. And then John, correct me if I'm misunderstanding it. So in principle, you say the higher the quality, the better. But then I guess you have difficulties coupling your qubits. Or to get in the signal, you have also, if you still get in the signal into your transmission line. And somehow, if you push it too high in qubits, in principle, you could, then this coupling becomes bad. And so, and for that reason, compromise, that was the optimum point.
Yeah, so in let me add to that. In the experiment, say, at Yale, they want to measure what's going on in the superconducting transmission line with an amplifier coupled to it. And in that case, you want to kind of have it strongly enough coupled to the amplifier so you can measure something. So in that case, you go to like a Q10 before so that you couple to the amplifier. If you didn't use the amplifier, if you used the qubits to measure it, then you could go to a Q10^6 and do all that. And that's, I think, where they're going to go. But for right now, they use a lower Q to measure it with an amplifier.
Is it possible to tune the coupling with an amplifier? Or?
Well, you can tune it when you build the circuit. But, you know, in situ, in principle, you can, but people are working on the technology to do that.
So it's not possible to protect the qubit while you're doing operation? Then
no, it's possible to change the coupling. And that's, I think, something people will do in the future.
One thing, while we're at this slide, this is something we can probably discuss in one of the discussion sessions, because that's something where we would like to learn more from quantum information. So you see two qubits in a cavity, and sure enough, you could put more into it. But if you want to have parallel interactions between multiple pairs of qubits, you very easily run out of modes. So the notion we learned on scalability for error correction, this is not scalable because you don't have unlimited parallel interactions which go all over the size of the computer, unless we're not understanding this properly. So if there's any way from the quantum information side to do error correction with these type of buses without parallel pairwise interactions, that would be wonderful.
See, what I consider this to be great because you can get long distance communication. But to use it as a bus where you're coupling all these things simultaneously is going to be not scalable, as you mentioned. So I think it's more useful as a long distance, not as a 100-qubit bus. Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure whether I understood your problem. So you're saying that if you have 5 or 6 or 20 of those qubits there, you...
So realistically, you can couple qubit 2 to qubit 7, but it will be very difficult to also couple qubit 3 to qubit 12 at the same time, where you would need different electromagnetic modes.
You could, if you sort of, you could off-resonantly couple through that mode, and you could use it at the same time for several qubits.
Well, you want, I guess, you talk about having specific qubits coupled.
Yeah.
You would probably say, no, you can also couple them all. Isn't that the difference?
Well, I mean, okay, the question is, of course, whether you can sort of put sort of maybe an extra sort of control fields on the individual qubits, but if you can do that, I think you can use the same mode to cover the different
qubits. Yes, with detune, you have to try to detune the individual qubits, and then you have them.
Maybe that's a good topic to earmark for one of the upcoming discussions. Huh?
I mean, it's really something.
The field thing drawing, and it can be drawn on the blackboard.
Let me just sum up what the two experiments, I mean, of the Yale and Delft groups. I mean, so the Yale group was looking at this, I mean, brought them to near resonance or in resonance. Actually, this is a big, we wrote a, I like to buy the qubit and the cavity, we wrote a Nature news on this paper. And so this picture then was produced by Nature, so I can reproduce it. Okay, so the experiment of the Yale group was looking at their Rabi splitting, the vacuum Rabi splitting, and you see here this resonance. It showed that this shows this particular term of physics, they use the discursive mode to read out the system. Whereas in the Delft group, it was strongly detuned, and then, as I indicated already before, they showed there are the oscillations between these two states, or these two states, one of which is shown here, and it showed the discordian transitions between two entangled states. a very recent experiment goes on with this way, again on this dispersive regime, again the Yale group. It was again this Hamiltonian where we had this AC Stark effect, which shifts the frequency of the oscillator, and it depends on the occupation, on the number of photon states, as you see here, and that's what they measured by studying the resonance of the qubit, and you see, let's say, the different photon occupation states and the amplitudes refer to what is the probability to have this particular photon state, and they could either drive it to have a coherent state, it looks like that, or they can just have a thermal state of the fact of this photon system, and it looks different, so they have to create a statistics analyzer. Okay, that was my review. I wanted to shortly describe two ongoing, say, activities. I will be short on it. It's something we are doing these days, trying to publish it in Nature Physics, but we were told the editor concluded he doesn't understand why it should be interesting. And we said, perhaps you don't understand, but the referees might understand, but then the referees agree with the editor. So it was an experiment done by Ilicev and Koppelberger in Vienna, who has a flux qubit, a three-junction flux qubit driven, AC driven to perform RP oscillations. Again, the frequencies, say, that are using the gigahertz regime, the RP frequency, the megahertz regime. And now, and that is something which has not been studied before, a resonance situation was achieved where this RP frequency wasn't resonant with the oscillator. And what they got is a substantial amplitude enhancement of this resonator, and if you get it into resonance, which was much higher than, say, what you could naturally expect. And what we conclude is that it's actually a Lasing state. My time is getting short, but let's say, again, we write Hamiltonian of the qubit, the resonator, the RP driving of the qubit, and the coupling to the oscillator, which we have here. And then, let's say, actually what we find, I anticipated, so it depends now on the detuning. For blue detuning of this driving here, of the driving frequency of the driven system, for blue detuning, we get this lasing, because actually the effective qubit state gets a population inversion, and that then creates this high enhancement of the modes in the oscillator. You can also have red detuning, in which case it gives rise to cooling.
You're actually cooling, your qubit is at, say, gigahertz,
yeah,
but you're actually cooling the six megahertz mode,
yes,
in the resonator,
yeah,
using the lobbies of the gigahertz.
You are perhaps astonished about that if you have such a high frequency, you still manage.
This is kind of, yes, strange. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So, can you do the same thing with the Waldorf setup? Why do you need these three junctions?
Because that was the experiment. That was the experiment. Ilicev had this flux qubit and three junction flux qubit and a real LC oscillator coupled to it. So not a transmission type. Actually, let's say one of the problems. So in the end, you don't get a good, quantitatively good agreement, and certainly in the experiment, the quality of that particular system was experimentally was not very high. So with a transmission line, you would expect a much higher Q, which we actually suggested, and we have been discussing it with some of the nanomechanical oscillator community,
right,
and they have the high Q. So that seems that the parameters would also work for coupling to a nanomechanical oscillator with a high Q, and then this would actually be better.
Can you explain why you get cooling? Maybe I missed that, of these modes.
Question is what you're... It's actually a bit highly non-trivial. I can slightly indicate. I mean, I'll show you something. Let me first say, I mean, if I just go... there was one more thing, parameter. So again, what is G? It depends on various things, and you get a certain value of this coupling strength. Now, many steps, say, transformations, rotating wave approximations further, you see you have a qubit oscillator system and a coupling. So the first one, this detuning here plays a role, how the Rabi frequency is detuned with respect to the oscillator, but except for that, it looks again like James Cummings. Now, the experiments have been done in order to minimize the coherence effects at the sweet spot, where the linear coupling vanishes, then actually the G1 vanishes, and that's why we actually also analyzed what happens if you have a two-photon excitation in that setup. And there's an additional term which gives rise to some instabilities. Now I come to your question, dissipation. In order to analyze it, we have the two sources of dissipation. You look at the time evolution of the density matrix, and you have, say, the qubit has the dissipation, and for our work, we assumed only spontaneous emissions to start with. And I still come back to, wait a second, this is not the end of the story. And for the resonator, we had also the dissipation, the usual linear form. So when you want to get some quantitative answers, clearly you have to talk about it. I just didn't do it before in my presentation, but it's an important part of the game. Now, surprisingly, if you go to this rotating frame, then the qubit was only supposed to relax from the higher state to the lower state, but in the rotating frame, you actually get also the reverse transitions, you get also upwards transition. And in fact, now it depends on the detuning. If you are blue detuned, then the upward transition rate is larger than the downward transition rate. And in the other case, for red detuning, it is going downhill. I can explain that in a picture. I don't really want to spend much time on it because my time is going. So let's say you would, the driving, you can say, also say, probably the quantum field. And then the effective two-state system is composed of, say, the lowest state here, the lower state here, and the higher state here. And so what is actually the state of your effective two-state system comes from the higher state. So before we had only relaxation from the higher to the lower, but now it's transition from ground state to excited state. So it's an upward transition. That's the population inversion which we get. And if you have radio tuning, we get a regular type of curve. Okay, so I show you the results which we got from it. It's the technique to proceed further is what we learned from laser theory. And you see there's a single photon resonance if we are not at the ideal point. But the two photon, I mean, so we are close to the ideal point, that's why the single photon resonance is weak, and the two photon resonance is stronger. Say if we would be perfectly at the ideal point, this lower one would vanish. We see a certain bistability. There's the strong increase in the blue detuned limit, and then this is the number of photons that we see the cooling on the other side.
So you still see the effect if there's first order coupling?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. But then let's say the coherence would be worse, and then experiments have not been performed at this point.
I mean, yes. Go back to the picture. Where let's see the cooling of
the qubit? That the number of so you cool the resonator. The qubit cools the resonator, which you see as n the number of modes. There's a thermal occupation around 30 for this particular number taken from the experiment, and then you see a decrease, which is here. Does it answer the question?
No, actually not. I mean. I see here just the photon numbers changes.
Yes.
Now, how does this affect on the qubit so that I can say that?
This is, I don't show the qubit, I only show the, we don't cool the qubit, we use the qubit to cool the resonator. The resonator, which was in, say, in a thermal state corresponding to n by 30.
I think in your previous slide you had somewhere a statement that the qubit gets a negative temperature.
Yes, the qubit gets an...
Gets inverted.
That's when it gets a negative temperature, gets inverted, that's when it does the lacing. Okay, negative temperature is creating extra photons, it's not cooling. It would be nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say it appears, I mean, the same system could be done to modify nanomechanical oscillators. We actually learned a new word. I mean, if you have this stimulated emission of sound, what is it, sound amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. This, we didn't invent the word, it's a SASER, not a laser, but a SASER. And so we have the realization of the SASER. Okay, I'll...
If you say that it was phonons, you could call it a phaser.
I had switched it at some point. At some point I started talking about phaser, but I, that was a bit...
You'll get more press if you call it a phaser.
Okay, so I'll should come to an end, and I actually have only two more transparencies before I sum up. That was, let's say, another system which has been studied in the literature, giving some reference to, and mostly in connection with this nanomechanical systems, was to couple a superconducting single electron transistor to such a, say, a nanomechanical resonator. Now, the different thing from, as compared to what I said before, is that now we drive a current through this, along this line. There's a chosen junction here and a chosen junction here, but also quasi-particle tunneling plays a role. So the process which we have in mind is that there's a coherent group of their tunneling here, and then you create a non-equilibrium state which relaxes by the further tunneling of two quasi-particles. I mean, I would need more time to really go into it, but for the moment, just let me say it shortly. So you actually have, say, a transition due to quasi-particle tunneling, and you provide the energy for this process by the current through the system. I'm now too short. I only want to show that, again, it has been studied in the literature by, say, this group which I mentioned before, just published this year, and what you get again, what you look at is, again, this population of this, typically applied, say, to a mechanical system now, to this mechanical oscillator, as a function of tuning and frequency. let's say our PhD student of mine was working on it already. This is his picture at the time when this was published in his work letter. He worked in a different parameter regime, but we get this multi-photon resonance in both cases. So let me sum up. What I tried to show you was that it's interesting to look at this superconducting chunk qubit systems coupled to oscillators. You can use the oscillator to couple and manipulate the qubit, or you can use it for communication. There is plenty of theory around. I mean, it started actually with, say, the Chirac and Solertype coupling mechanism. But I think I have not seen a really good experiment here. I will be happy to be corrected, but the coupling via that oscillator, I haven't really seen, but let's say perhaps we come to different conclusions in the course of this meeting here. The reverse has been discussed. You can use the qubit to manipulate the mesh of the oscillator. Theory has been around. Ashberg has contributed to that. Again, Lin Tian and Peter Soller and Safra Schwingen. This is what has been done in experiments of Waldorf et al., Kilichev et al., in nanomechanical systems has been pursued. So in both of these cases, you use one for control and the other is your actual quantum system. But there are also examples where the two qubit and oscillator appear on an equal footing. I would say the Delft experiment, which I showed, was such an experiment. There you made an entangled state out of the qubit and the oscillator, not using one as a detector and the other as a quantum system. So that is around. That is work which, that is what I tried to indicate shortly with my last example. That is not only the qubit, but that was actually this superconducting set which was driven. You drive a current through it, you have a voltage. It's actually a dissipative system. And again, you get such laser-type behavior. If you then look at it, it's a bit like driving an ordinary laser where you have an atom, you drive it by a field, and you have this metastable state and so forth. So there is also some activities, not only qubits, but other quantum systems, I call it a better word for the moment, which sometimes are the dissipative regime. Now, a short attempt to just find out some open problems, places where future work should be and will be directed to. With all the solid state devices, the major problem is the decoherence and relaxation. And this is still ongoing work. We understand more today than we understood 5 years ago, but we still have more and more open questions. what are the sources, what are the rates, what are the decay laws, how can I reduce an experiment? And all the experiments with the solid state qubits will rely very much on progress in this direction. An ongoing activity now is to go beyond the simple qubit experiments, but try to couple them, show that this is under control. That is what now, this, I mean, it started really, I mean, these experiments of the Yale group showed that there's a lot of excitement in studying these qubit oscillator coupled systems and the manipulations for, the possibilities for manipulations in measurement are still to be explored further. There's also the idea to use, say, the oscillator to store the information, the qubit as a logical element, and then store it in an oscillator. That is theory proposals, and it would be nice to see something being done along this right line. Finally, I mentioned the last example that not only qubits, Korean qubits, but also distributive quantum system can be used in combination with such oscillators.
Further questions or comments or? Yes, Dan.
So you mentioned the tangents, the effect of 1/8 north, and then you basically said shrug your shoulders and said, well, we have to just live with this. Surely the work of the last few years has pointed to the fact that we just don't have the faintest clue where whatever influence comes from, and that it may be rather dangerous, in fact, to go ahead with large scale quantum computing until we do.
It's a I would say you are right and only partially right in the following sense that, I mean, there are experiments, and John Martini's experiments is a good example, and there are more examples where we have a good feeling for the sources of at the two-level fluctuators, somewhere in the substrate, somewhere in the oxide. Now, and then, of course, the next thing is to improve the experiment, to improve the oxide, and so forth. And however, then what is the typical observation after that is that you have still 1/8 noise at a lower level, but it continues to be there. This is what you say. I mean, it continues to be there in a lower level. We have been doing some work where we could understand something in an experiment done by Astafiev et al. And it was, in a sense, a bad experiment. It had a lot of 1/8 noise. And it was a good experiment for us because there was one dominant 1/8 source, maybe, again, somehow two-level fluctuators, which dominated everything else, and then we got correlations between the low and high frequency spectrum based on the observation it's one dominant system of two-level fluctuators responsible for it. Now, if you have an improved experiment and get rid of these strong fluctuators, then again we are in the fog, we don't know where this remaining algorithm comes from. So that's, I guess, has been probably happening a few times in history. Huh? People noticed where there is a fluctuator, got rid of it, and then there was still 1/8 noise, but on a lower level. So that is perhaps the progress.
Yeah, and I would just comment that if you think about making the Pentium a processor in your computer, you would never have thought that that was possible in the 50s when the transistor was invented. So I kind of think that what we're doing now experimentally is kind of like the technology of the 50s making transistors. And it's only as we learn what all these sources of noises and improve upon things can we bring up the technology to make something complex. And you said a lot of work to do.
I just wanted to make the point really, but I think it's a huge theoretical question. But to the extent that we just don't understand the generality, we may.
It is absolutely, I mean, yeah, I fully agree. I mean, this universality of the 1/8 noise is a puzzle, and there's always the hope that perhaps at some stage we get this fundamental insight in why it arises, so it could just be as it does.
So, I was going to just ask, and maybe this 1/8 noise is the reason why you couldn't do this, but for example, in cold atom, trapped cold atom systems, you know, people talk about doing quantum information, and it's this large and difficult problem that involves a lot of engineering, but there's a shorter step to the simulations of many-body Hamiltonians, simple, well-defined many-body Hamiltonians. I'm wondering, can you do that in these systems as well, or is it one of killing that as well? Because we have these really coherent systems, and it's really the control issue and the scaling issue, but you can do these many-body things. Can you not ask for something quite so complicated engineering-wise and actually get some interesting physics out of it? Like just, you know,
I mean, you ask, I mean, can we use the solid state device? Not that the modeling, I'm possibly confused about the question because you use just this code.
What I mean is instead of making a sort of scalable arbitrary array of arbitrarily coupled qubits that you can then do computing with, can you make something that's much more in parallel but it looks like a many-body Hamiltonian that might be interesting to people? So the qubits would be spins and they only have nearest neighbor interactions, and if they're all the same nearest neighbor interactions, and you make interesting 2D or maybe even 3D if you do the coupling up in some. I mean, does the 1 over F get in the way? Because that seems like, at least for the atom, the atomic field, that's an easier first step by a long shot than the more complicated things.
I think we might be getting close to the point where we could start really designing up something and seeing if that was interesting. I mean, there's a lot of hard things to do, and it depends what you're really getting after. If you're trying to get a simple spectrum with some, you know, where you want to see some peak at some pretty reasonable effective Rabi frequency, yeah, we can probably do that without the 1 over F killing us. But I think we're getting a little bit close to where we can start thinking about that seriously.
How would this quantum simulator be upgraded relative to the Jonas induction array?
Well, I think in the case of simulators involving atoms, they do it on a stroboscopic level, right? You switch on and off the coupling to simulate dynamics, and this would be...
That's an example, but I mean, there are non-stroboscopic ways.
Because with static system, I think with Josephson arrays, people already, for instance, they measure superconductor insulator transition.
Right, but I mean, I'm wondering what is the class, I don't know anything about it, so what is the class of Hamiltonians you can do? I mean, the... Right, so, and can you try other stuff in any set of quantum magnetism type things where the qubits would be your spin states and you would gear up
XY models you have?
Well, this is what D-Wave is trying to do, but they're trying to build a quantum computer without quantum coherence, so I have no idea if they can succeed. Okay?
That's a different line, yeah.
Yes.
So, I think there's an activity in Hans Moll's group trying to use qubits for simulating a quantum Ising chain, so this was the Ising chain. So you should ask him, because Hans Moll is coming in, I think, tonight, so he will be with us most of the time of the conference.
So, further comments or questions?
Yes.
When I think about your question, it sounds like you're saying that you have good coherence but bad control of many qubits. Is that right?
Bad scaling control.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's why you're able to do this to set in that one set. But they don't have individual qubit coherence, so I think the answer is it doesn't work very well. I don't know about this example, but somebody mentioned it.
It's not miserable.
Okay, but
we would like it better. Absolutely.
Perhaps we should say, I mean, let's say we have this relatively long or short, depends on what you compare to, coherent time. Let me say as a scale, as a message perhaps of this first lecture, say a microsecond. On the other hand, say a typical frequency is, or time scale is 100 picoseconds. So in principle, we have factored 10 to the 4 different there. Now, okay, the 100 picoseconds is perhaps a bit too optimistic. If you do Rabi drive, you need longer, you need this factor 10.
Plus, you have to be able to read it out.
I mean, so we don't have the 10 to the 4, which the magic 10 to the 4 from there.
We have about 100.
Right.
Good. And you can do stuff with 100.
I guess what I'm looking for is, you know, when they made a transistor, there were a million uses immediately.
Yeah.
And then we had four transistors on a thing, there were 10 million uses immediately. And it just sort of worked its way up.
Yeah.
And it'd be nice to have uses that weren't 50 years down the line, you know, where you've got to make a Pentium out of this thing once you invent it.
Exactly. And the simulation is a nice round to get right out.
No further questions.
Yeah.
Yes, you
have. I will defer this to the discussion because I think it's the time for coffee. But one thing, just so we see in this 1/f noise, the level gets lower and lower, and in principle, error correction tells us it doesn't have to get infinitesimally low. But there's a very weird Markovian decay law. Remember, it's e to the minus t squared log t. So maybe that's something we could discuss whether, you know, in the enterprise of building non-Markovian error correction, we have any idea what is the threshold for 1/f noise being a bit split noise, local, and in a weird way non-Markovian.
And you have to add to that that, and this is why I know the ion, Dave Wyman and ion traps do that. You know, they have a pretty stable system, but they're doing spin echo to get rid of various drifts. So you have to throw spin echo, because we're going to put a lot of spin echo sequences. And then, what happens when it's kind of like scales quadratically. If you improve the 1/f dephasing by factor 10, you spin echo, then it's kind of like a factor of 100, I think.
Yeah.
So understanding that would be really good.
Can I have a last remark?
Sure.
From the advertising at our university. And the deadline is Saturday, but if you rush, the first meeting of the committee is next Monday, so if you have more questions, please.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again.